The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Day earlier than normal extra. The Women's World Cup quarter-final lineup is complete. The Dutch taking the final place with one of those handballs. I'm angry already. Somebody change the laws before it's too late, please. Italy, US and Sweden all make it through, which means England will beat Norway, the States and then the Netherlands on their way to World Cup glory. Elsewhere, Rafa has gone. Frank Lampard's derby give Frank Lampard permission to talk to Chelsea and Spurs might buy someone, while Luis Suarez is just desperate to get someone booked for something. We'll do all that, take your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Philippe Auclair. Bonjour, ça va?
Bonjour, ça va.
How much of today's pod do we need to set aside for FIFA discussions?
The usual portion, which will end up on the cutting floor.
Absolutely.
As per usual.
Do you have anything legally sound to say about Michel Platini?
Not really,
though. Okay, excellent. Chris Powers, how are you doing?
Really good, thanks, Max.
You were in Valenciennes to watch England-Cameroon.
And it was the most bonkers game I've ever seen.
Excellent news. We'll talk about it in a bit. Hey, Baz.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
And you.
You're looking well.
Thanks.
That's okay. Right. Holland 2, Japan 1. The injustice of it all, right? Andy Thomas sent a tweet saying it's absolutely fascinating that football has ended up in a place where the only natural position for a defender's arm is tucked extremely unnaturally behind their body. And that is it, Philippe, isn't it? That's it.
Oh, dear. I still haven't recovered from that game. I don't think Chris has. I don't think anybody has yet.
We feel terrible for the Japanese.
We wanted, yeah.
I still haven't recovered from the injustice of the USA-Spain game, which I'm sure we'll get to, but I haven't had time yet to be outraged by the injustice visited upon Japan.
So look, it was the last minute. Viviana Miedema had a shot. It struck the hand of Saki Kumagai. She must have been a foot away, maybe 3 feet away from her. It also looks like the ball went out of play. I mean, it could have. I don't know if that's true. Just, you disagree with that, Philippe? Just on the byline.
No, I don't disagree with you. I didn't know that the ball might have come.
Well,
out of play.
It did go out of play, didn't it? Because the Netherlands players were appealing for a corner,
rather than
a penalty.
I thought when the winger, the Dutch winger on the right, slightly miscontrolled it.
Oh, sorry,
and I thought the ball
might have
gone out of play there. Anyway, it's a penalty. They're the laws of football, Chris. What can we do about it? I've started tweeting IFAB every day.
Well, I think that's probably right. I've got no idea what IFAB were doing. It's almost like they would need to justify their existence by like making up new laws, just to kind of give themselves a reason to exist. As I say, because it doesn't make any sense. How is it making the game better? I mean, it's going to turn into some weird. I can imagine it next season. You're going to have some weird form of dodgeball where people are going to be kicking the ball at people's arms in the penalty area, because it doesn't matter where you are in the area. Kick it at someone's arm, you're going to get a pen.
Philippe, you've got something on your phone. What is it?
Yeah, it's about the laws of the game and IFAB. And also the crazy thing is that IFAB was probably the most conservative body in the history of sport, changing laws, you know, every 30 years or so. And generally being quite good about changing the laws, like the offside, the change to the offside law, then the tackle from behind and the keeper not being able to gather the ball with his hands when there's a back pass and so forth. But this is crazy. It's like a machine has been put in overdrive by Gianni Infantino, because it's now FIFA which controls IFAB. But I've looked at the, or rather somebody else did for me, at the actual law, and I've read it, and I think the penalty, even according to the new law, shouldn't have been given. Listen to that. The following will not usually be a free kick or a penalty if it's in a box. If the ball touches a player's hand or arm directly from their own head, body, foot, or the head, body, foot of another player who is close near, which means that there is no...
Sorry,
it's not
can you
automatic.
Say that again? I there was just too many heads, shoulders, knees and toes for me.
Yeah, no, basically it means that the idea that it touches the arm, it's an automatic penalty, is complete rubbish. It's that the referee doesn't have to give a pen because the ball touches the arm.
That sounds to me as well, though, that the penalty against Sissoko shouldn't have been a penalty.
Exactly.
I'm still quite keen for them to go back and just give that as an indirect free kick.
Yeah, I'm up for that too.
Barry, do you want us to stop talking about the handball law yet?
Well, it needs to be discussed, I suppose. But if that is how the law has been interpreted, then Japan can't really have too many complaints. And to be fair, they didn't really complain. But it is lunacy. The law is an ass.
I felt really sorry for them as well, because they played beautifully. The interplay was incredible. They were really fast on the ball. There were these lovely little triangles. They played so beautifully. And for them to come out of that game with at least without extra time is a travesty. Mm.
Japan have brought 17 players to this World Cup. It's their first World Cup for 17 of their players. They are building towards the Olympics, aren't you? Yeah. And from the way they played yesterday, certainly compared to the England game where they were considerably worse. But if you watch that game yesterday, you think, Philippe, they'd have a good chance in the Olympics.
I hope so. I mean, the football they played, I think, you know, I felt really enthusiastic as a neutral, especially the way that they were able to fight against the physical domination of the Dutch, much stronger, quicker, and they managed to actually dominate them and should have won because of their fabulous skill, the wonderful interplay. Superb organization. It's like they, for me, the team they made me think of, I said, we were talking, Chris and I, before the pod, I was thinking of the way that Ajax played against Real Madrid. It's like, we're going to beat you by playing this beautiful football, which is all about triangles, knowing exactly where your teammate is. And they did that twice, because the second half as well, they started a bit under the cushion. Then they got back into the game and they had so many chances. And yes, I mean, for 2020, it's a very young team. Average age is what?
22, 23.
Really building for that. Wouldn't read anything in the defeat against England, to be honest. It was dead rubber, wasn't it? More or less.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah. So I wouldn't read anything in that. But the talent is there. The game, I mean, the play is there. The tactical setup is there. Everything. I mean, I do hope that they go and get the gold medal in Tokyo. And I think everybody who watched the game yesterday really wants them to win something.
Yeah, I don't. There's no doubt the better team lost that game, but they are lacking cutting edge. They missed at least three excellent scoring chances, and so while they were unlucky ultimately, they don't really have anyone to blame but themselves.
And cutting edge that the Dutch have. I mean, Lieke Martin's finish for that first goal was sublime. Mm-hmm. It was sublime. So, you know, at that moment as well, you think, well, actually, a goal like that deserves to be in a winning team too, you know, so.
Now, Miedema's my favourite player, but should I prefer Lieke Martins? Chris, what's the pecking order of Dutch
attackers? As far as I know, I think Lieke Martins is the one, is purportedly one of the best players in world football. And also, Miedema, doesn't she play for a certain North London team? Max, what are you doing preferring her?
Well, that's okay. My allegiance to Tottenham is as so far as I can still appreciate Arsenal.
Okay.
So someone will abuse me for that, I'm
sure. Rather you than me. I think, just back to the law, I think the problem with the laws, sorry to go on about it, is that you want to see law changes that improve the game and bring competitive balance and fairness. And then you want to see it applied properly. And I think the combination of new laws and then VAR, that I can't really figure out who's making the VAR calls. Is it the ref? Is it someone in their ear? I can't figure that out either. So the combination of those two things, we end up conflating them as well in this World Cup because it's not clear what's what. It's just kind of, it's mayhem. Mm.
It would be nice if the person in their ear was the comedian who did the skit on Boris making cardboard buses. Just give a penalty, just shouting penalty at random times. The ref just gives it. So the Dutch play Italy now. And it's interesting, that side of the draw, isn't it? Italy beat China 2-0. Goals in either half from Valentina Giacinti and Aurora Galli.
Another superb goal by Galli.
Yeah, lovely goal. I don't really feel either of those two sides are that good.
Perhaps not, but I'd put Italy before the tournament as one of my outside bets. I think that there is the spirit within that team is absolutely wonderful. There's absolutely no pressure whatsoever. They're obviously enjoying themselves tremendously, having the bit of a rub of the green as well, which helps. And no complex whatsoever. They're perhaps not as strong as some of the other teams in the draw, but they've got, I don't know, this impetus, this momentum about them. And some, I mean, terrific players, I think Galli in particular. Even though she came on as a sub only in this particular game. A bit surprising.
The head coach, Milena Bertolini, said, look, we really believe this side has allowed the women's game to break new ground back home. We can see that from the viewing figures, what we see in the press, and from the messages we receive from back home. And that's, you know, women's football in Italy, we've talked about it before, is really behind the curve, right? And this is...
When it was ahead of it at one point. There was one point where Juve was actually a very, very, very good and a very, very good women's team, and then the money came out and went out of the game and to bring to this situation.
But I think that's what's happening across this World Cup, is that the, you know, nations are taking this opportunity for it to be the moment where the women's game is making a step in their country. And I think that's part of the issue as well, because that's, there's so much pressure. Like, every single game is somehow some kind of judgment on the women's game overall, which we never do ordinarily in football. It's just a game of football. Whereas now it's just like, oh, but what about this? And what's it going to mean for, what's the implication going to be for our national game?
Mm. Or for young women in Pisa.
Yes.
You know, yeah. It's an interesting point. I mean, it makes it more stressful if every football match has to be a major judgment.
Well, I think that's what happened to Cameroon, to be fair. I think there was something about that was like, you know, Philippe and I were talking about this before the game. You know, there was something about, you know, the pressure of 1990 being on their heads. You know, they were hard done by the English in 1990. You have the manager there saying the referee is going to favour the English in this game. The woeful underinvestment of women's football in Cameroon is right there. Imagine if that team had turned that around against the English after nearly 30 years of misery and feeling hard done by the English, what that could do for the women's game. And then the whole thing just crumbles. Yeah. Think of all that pressure.
30 years of hurt. I mean, it's unfair to put the hurt on some people who weren't even born when the hurt,
exactly.
The hurt began.
Exactly.
You know, it's almost like, you know, Jeffrey Boycott claiming he fought in two world wars, isn't it? So who's going to win out of Holland and Italy then, Barry?
I will say Holland. And that is the answer I am giving for that question.
That's an excellent answer. Round of applause from the back. Do we all go with that? I think they're probably
agree with Barry, but I think...
Why do you hate to agree with Barry?
I just kind of feel like we should be set up in opposition to one another.
Okay, all right.
We'll see how it goes as we go on today, yeah. But yeah.
I mean, it's taking on a big gun on your second appearance.
I'm all right with that.
Okay, fine. Barry, Spain 1, USA 2. The injustice of it all.
This was, I think, a shocking decision. The USA got two penalties. First one was fine. Megan Rapinoe scored it. Spain equalised. They played very well, and they gave the United States plenty to think about. And then Rose Lavelle goes down, I think, quite easily. There may have been contact. Contact isn't verboten. You know, it is a contact sport. People clatter into each other all over the pitch, body slam together. It's you know, football. And
they don't often body slam, you know, not like sort of Bret the Hitman.
I'm making
Hart.
It sound very sexual and intense, aren't I?
I've never body slammed anyone during my fun time, but you know, whatever.
Maybe you're not doing it right, Matt.
I get up on the turnbuckle and I hurl myself. Knock the current Mrs. Russian out with a chair. That's what gets her going. Anyway, but yes, I take your point. There wasn't a lot of contact, and it was kind of an exaggerated... She almost hit a triple jumpers.
Yeah, and the ball was long gone, so I didn't think it should have been a penalty, but it was. People are saying that the USA's weak spot is their defence, that they're a very attacking team, but they're very vulnerable at the back. Their goal, the Spanish goal, did come from a defensive blunder. But having said that, that's the first goal the USA have conceded in about 640 minutes of football. So they can't be that vulnerable at the back, or perhaps they haven't been played very good opposition. But I thought Spain were unlucky.
I hate to say it again, but I agree with him. I think that was never a penalty. Rose Lavelle was running away from the goal. It was an exaggerated movement. Anyone who's ever played any football knows that she didn't have to fall over at that moment, and she decided to. But I think that was her game all over. She was over enthusiastic the whole game. You know, there were over hit passes and, you know, etc. And it shouldn't have been a pen.
Simulation in the women's game. What's going on?
I mean, I want there to be more shithousery in the women's game. Lots of people say how, you know, wonderful.
Well, we'll come to shithousery later.
Oh, yeah.
Very far. You know, there's a long way to go.
You're absolutely right. So what can France learn from how Spain played, Philly? Because for me, it was the first time I saw the US as being at all vulnerable. I just presumed they were going to win every game.
I think for France, I mean, they know the USA inside out. It's not a question of knowing how to play against the USA. It's a question of knowing how the French team can finally relax a little bit into its own game. Finding out if Corinne Diacre is a little bit too much like Didier Deschamps, which is the one thing that people have always said about her, is that. But on the other hand, Didier Deschamps won the World Cup. And it's a very French team in that. It makes me think of what happened in 2018. It makes me think of what happened in 1998. They're like, not very convincing. I mean, half a game against South Korea, perhaps. That was that. Then going through the motions, being a bit lucky against Brazil, who was supposed to be an easier opponent with, again, defensive frailties. But I think that they're going to come into their game at this stage, and which is why I see them doing something.
What does it feel like to follow a country who've won the World Cup, Philippe?
Just natural. It's just natural order of things, my friend.
That's the most French reaction I've heard from you. Megan Rapinoe's got lots of praise for saying, I'm not going to the fucking White House. I mean, that's not how she sounds, but sort of my American. Do we now approve of everything she does? I don't know a lot about her, and I've sort of started following her just solely on that basis.
Well, I commend anyone for not going to visit the White House, but I kind of got the impression she was saying that on the assumption that they wouldn't be invited to the White House. I mean, fair dues. I mean, why would anyone want to go and visit Donald Trump in the White
House?
Hang
on, if Donald asked you, Barry, would you go?
No.
What if he paid for your flights?
No.
What if he played for a round of golf at Mar-a-Lago?
Nothing upsets me more than seeing professional golfers teeing off with Donald Trump. Not only is he a terrible man, he also cheats at golf. So
I thought you hated golf.
No, I don't hate golf.
Yeah, he does cheat at golf, which is ludicrous. I mean, that's just, you can't, you just literally, you know, standing in the on the green going, 1, 2, 3. It's ridiculous.
She always said she wouldn't go to the White House. And very early on in support of what Colin Kaepernick was doing with taking a knee, she did the same before a US women's national team game. And then
did she get a lot of flack for that?
She did get some flack. And the US Soccer Federation sort of changed the rules and said, you're not allowed to. Mm. And after that, she said, okay, well, I'll respect that. And she's never she hasn't sung the national anthem since. And I think that creates some sadness for her, that she says, I can't support the national anthem. But with, you know, she's an out lesbian, and obviously that's not a great, it's obviously not great under the current administration to be an out lesbian. So I think that's the other thing for her, is like, look at all of these things that are happening on the borders to the LGBT community, etc. I can't sing the national anthem. So I'm not surprised she wouldn't go to the White House, whether they were invited or not.
Mm-hmm. Sweden beat Canada 1-0. Not many chances in this one. The big moment was Canada being awarded another one of those penalties, and a lot made of Sinclair not taking the penalty. Why does, you know, she's the sort of notion that your best player by definition is the penalty taker seems a bit strange. You know, somebody wants to take the penalty.
Well, you saw the Becky said afterwards that Sinclair said to her, do you want to take it, and gave her the ball and said, you know, she'd had a really good game, Becky, right? So I can sort of see how that would have been the case.
Was Sinclair the designated penalty taker then?
I think so, yeah.
Well, then that is
the captain, and the captain and the designated penalty taker, as far as I understand it. I think the other interesting thing about Canada, though, is that, you know, don't forget that Canadian soccer moved their most successful women's national team coach to the men's team and then just hired his assistant. So that, and that was all before the World Cup. So there's been a little bit there as well that, you know, that it comes down to Sinclair because the manager's apparently not really doing his thing.
Right, okay. How do we rate Sweden's chances against Germany in the quarterfinal, Philippe?
Not very highly, I think.
I agree with Philippe.
It's too much agreement in this pod.
Do you hate to say it, but you agree with them, Baron?
I think Sweden will batter Germany.
You were at the England-Cameroon game. Since then, this is Rob Harris tweeting today, Phil Neville says a virus is going through the England camp ahead of the quarterfinal against Norway. Millie Bright, a major doubt. She's stuck in her room. Steph Horton, also a doubt with an ankle injury after that terrible tackle. I mean, no Brighton, no Horton. Philippe would be a pretty disastrous.
Yeah, and in any case, even with them in the side, I wouldn't fancy their chances too much against this very impressive Norwegian side, which has got some exceptional individualities. Looks very solid, and up front, my goodness, they're terrifying at times, especially Graham Hansen. Again, we were talking about her. She's, for me, the player of the tournament so far.
From within the stadium, from where I was watching on telly, I didn't think England were that strong against Cameroon. I don't know what you get a different view of the pitch right if you're there.
Absolutely, and I think actually the I thought Kira Walsh had a better game than sort of seeing reports afterwards. She was just really tidy in midfield, and she gave Jill Scott loads of space to move around, and she just kept the ball moving. So I think if she can sort of do something similar this time, where she kind of guards the back four in that way and gives Jill Scott the space, I think that'll be great. I'm slightly worried down the left, because I saw Norway Australia on Saturday night as well, because they were playing in Nice, and you know they ran a mock down the left hand side, and you know Lucy Bronze is a brilliant player, but she likes getting forward too. So I think we've got to stay really, really disciplined.
I worry about us, you know, on the, because Paris and Bronze are, you know, very good going forward, but we don't seem to have a lot on the left hand side. We seem quite imbalanced. I just wonder if there would be a way of getting Daly and Paris, you know, could Paris play on the left?
Well, Duggan and Paris switched a couple of times, actually, in the Cameroon game. So, you know, they were switching the whole time, and you could see they were agreeing that between themselves. There weren't instructions coming from the bench. They were just kind of reading the game themselves and saying, actually, let's switch this around. So that was quite interesting. But I think Alex Greenwood and Tony Duggan had sort of some understanding down the left as well, actually. I mean, that second... the third goal, sorry, was tremendous. And that was obviously like straight off the training ground. And the technicality of it was fantastic.
How good is Tony Duggan? Because obviously she's been coming back from injury, hasn't she? And so she certainly looked better against Cameroon than she did against Japan. But
Tony Duggan's a very good player. I mean, she plays for Barcelona. They were Champions League finalists. You don't get to that level without being a really, you know, without being a really good player. I don't think we've seen the best of her yet. And I think if we ever figure out which... Phil Neville's sort of best 11 is, she'd likely be in it.
If Bright or Horton are out, who's England women's Matthew Upson?
I think it's going to be Abby McManus. Okay. And she has already played in this World Cup when Phil Neville made the changes for the second game.
The Argentina game.
Yeah, for the Argentina game, she was playing. So, you know, she's had some game time. In fact, I think the only player that hasn't had any game time is Mary Earps, the third keeper.
That's right.
Everybody else has played. So, you know, I think she'll be ready for it. I don't know what they're going to do if they're both out. I imagine they're going to have to make some kind of adjustments from fullback. I think there's some fullbacks that can play in central defence.
But what was worrying against Cameroon and a Cameroon team which was completely hyper and not playing at its best and quite disorganised? I mean, the number of times they still managed to create overloads, situations where, I mean, it was like after the goal, which was not a goal, there was a situation where suddenly two Cameroon's attacking players found themselves in the 18-yard box with about 2 yards of space, each of them. And this happened time and time and time again, when you would have thought that perhaps it would be one of the strengths of this England team. And actually, it doesn't look particularly well organised or balanced at the back, does it?
You would also be concerned that, you know, obviously we don't know the details of this virus, but it could lay several other players low without necessarily ruling them out. And that is a big worry. But at least... Miss Havisham will have something to blame if his team do go out.
I guess the other thing is this all kind of uber mind games? Because actually watching, you know, Steph Horton's a doubt, allegedly, but anyone who saw some of the videos of the team playing on the beach yesterday, they were playing with like cups and water shooters. She was jumping up and down with the best of them. That didn't look like an injured ankle to me, necessarily.
Barry, did you see any good water pistol use there as our resident expert in this field?
I haven't seen this, but my understanding is that Steph Houghton just got a clatter on the shin, so I suspect
they'll all be all right, won't they? It's in Le Havre. How hot is it over there, Philippe?
Not very. It's my town.
Is it your town?
Well, it's the club I support. Is there a
blue plaque? Plaque de bleu?
Plaque bleu? No, there isn't. Not yet. Wonderful city, by the way, which I encourage you to visit. Unusual city.
What are the top three things to do in Le Havre?
First of all, enjoy the architecture of this town, which was rebuilt in the 1950s, which is a masterpiece of modernist architecture, an absolutely astonishing church as well, modernist one. Beautiful beaches.
What about interesting, fun things to do?
I visited the beaches.
You can visit the Philippe Auclair blue plaque.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I visited, passed through Le Havre when I was covering the 2015 Tour de France. I cannot remember a single thing about it.
Should have called me beforehand.
Because it's just doing the tour. It's just, you know, it's what I imagine a band being on tour is like. You don't actually get to see anything or register anything.
You just go, hello, Cleveland. Yeah. Carry on. All right, so then the full quarterfinal draw. Norway, England. We all think Norway are going to win, which is a shame.
But in our hearts, we want England to win, obviously.
Well, obviously. Yeah, and when I'm watching, I will believe they will win until they go out heroically on penalties. You think the French will beat the USA, Philippe, do you?
I think they will, yes.
No. USA.
Barry?
I'll go USA. Yeah.
Netherlands, Italy, we're giving to Netherlands. And so it'll be a Netherlands, Germany. We don't know versus Norway in the semi-final. Seven of the eight quarterfinals from Europe. Is this where women's football is, or is this a quirk?
It's the same as in every game, where the money is, the best performers are, and that's the beginning and the end of it, I'm afraid.
That's why we are all in this room, and not on television.
Which are the countries which have invested in women's football properly? The countries which can afford it decide, and which means, like, for example, Japan is there, Korea was there, and so forth, and European countries, of course.
All right.
I mean, the same thing goes in any sport. And you know, we were talking about the investment of, for example, in African football, African women's football. It's absolutely appalling. I know that the payment was made of $150,000 to each federation, and you might remember what happened to the Somali federation, who basically took the money away from the women and just used it for something else. So it's not really a priority.
Righto. More soapbox from Philippe in part three, I believe, and probably in part two as well. And we'll begin part two with Rafa Benitez leaving Newcastle United. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra on a Wednesday, not a Thursday. So we finished recording the pod at midday on Monday, and it's 12:02. Newcastle United announced that Rafa was leaving the club. I mean, I don't believe that, you know, Mike Ashley listens to the pod, but that's how it felt anyway. So
that doesn't work.
What do you mean? Oh yeah,
the pod isn't live.
Yeah, but if a real true listener would know about when we stop recording.
Oh, okay.
Ashley's a real purist. He's below the line all the time making comments. Newcastle said, we have worked hard to extend Rafa's contract over a significant period of time. It has not been and will not be possible to reach an agreement with Rafa and his representatives. The process to appoint a successor will now begin. Alan Shearer on Twitter, world-class manager, a manager who performed so well in very difficult circumstances, a manager who understood the fans. Thanks and good luck. Rafa Benitez, you were brilliant for the tune. Hashtag shambles. Philippe, a shambles?
Yeah, I think we can all agree on that again. Inconceivable, actually. And what is even more inconceivable is that it seems there is no shortlist of managers who could take over from Rafa Benitez, even though we knew that this was not necessarily going to happen, but it was going to come to a head, and that there had to be a plan B in place just in case things didn't pan out as Ashley perhaps wished. That is really worrying, and I'd be very interested to know the odds on Newcastle being relegated next season. I think they must have shot up.
Yeah, they've really shortened.
It doesn't make any sense. Sometimes you have statements from clubs saying, you know, common agreement that, you know, to put an end to. So in this case, it looks that it was a common disagreement, and I think that's the way to put it. But it's a disaster for the tune.
I think the thing to bear in mind, though, is that Mike Ashley had a 10-year plan when he joined Newcastle, and it was to have 5 years in the Premier League and 5 years not, right? And he's managed 8-2 so far, so he's way ahead of schedule in terms of what he wants to achieve. Now, it is a disaster for the tune, it's a disaster for the fans, but Mike Ashley is ahead of his plan, so this all works for him.
And it's understood that this won't affect the proposed takeover between Mike Ashley and Sheikh Khaled bin Zayed Al Nahyan's investment group?
Well, it's difficult to see how that can possibly be true, because by not having Rafael Benitez in charge, you'd imagine the value of the club is being reduced by a huge amount.
Yeah.
And Ashley is already overvaluing it, so, you know, I can't see how it wouldn't affect any potential takeover.
Does he really want to sell it?
I don't know. I mean, the idea is that he wants to sell it at one point to make a shitload of money. That's the plan, isn't it? That's the grand plan. But the other thing, and I can't quite understand why this new owner, who seems very opaque, by the way, and wild stories circulate about who he is, how much money he's got, his relationship with Sheikh Mansour and so forth. How would that be, you know, the salvation of Newcastle? I don't know. There's something kind of wishful thinking here, which has been going on and on and on for years, as if the solution to every trouble was, you know, to have a new owner who is going to plough hundreds of millions into this club. It won't happen like that.
And
they've just lost their biggest asset.
When Ashley took over, Newcastle fans were thrilled to bits with this new sugar daddy. So that hasn't worked out too well for them. I wonder, I just think Mike Ashley has got to the point. He knows that Newcastle fans, and I have as much sympathy as one can, you know, being a Sunderland fan, but I'm not from the area, so I've nothing against them. But they talk a lot, they complain a lot with huge justification, but ultimately they never do anything about it. They still go, they still turn up in their droves, and until they actually decide, you know what, not going, let's boycott Newcastle's games.
Well, isn't that what some people are saying, actually campaigning? I mean, if Rafa goes,
it never happens. They still go. He knows they'll go. And he doesn't care whether they complain or not. Talk is cheap. Now, admittedly, it's a sacrifice for them. You know, they may have already paid for a season ticket. A lot of them argue, oh, we're supporting the team, when we go to games, not the regime. But that's not true. You are supporting the regime by turning up, by being there when the cameras are there. It's a full house. That is only helpful to Ashley.
Well, it's so hard to not go, right?
It really isn't.
Of course it is. Look at the evidence. What good does it do? Poor old Blackpool fans against the Oystons. Years and years and years of boycott. They finally managed it. But imagine, like, football becomes, you know, part of your weekly routine, part of the way that you see your friends, the way that you kind of, you know, like, sort of make sense of your weekend life often. And then what, you don't go because of that. It's like you're punishing yourself for something that somebody else is doing.
Well, I'd argue that Blackpool, A, their fan protest ultimately worked, as you said, and B,
Blackpool... It did, but it took a long time.
Well, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day.
You can be happy to disagree, I guess, on this.
Maybe we should add at this point that, regardless of Mike Ashley's faults, we should not compare him to the Oystons.
No. Okay, fair.
Yeah, that's fair.
But
also, Blackpool aren't a Premier League side. If a Premier League side is appearing regularly on television with no fans in the stands, that's not a good look, and that's embarrassing for the owner.
Harry Saville, who's runs a Newcastle fanzine website called The Spectator's View, wrote in The Guardian about Rafa. It's so interesting to think about Rafa actually taking the Newcastle job. He's been there long enough for me to think, oh yeah, it's Rafa at Newcastle. But what an extraordinary move for him it was.
Saying, and to stay.
Rafa saw the value in the project, the fans, the unrealised potential of a club that had been cut adrift for too long. He says, look, his gritty style earned famous victories against Manchester United, Manchester City, Spurs, Chelsea and Arsenal. Arguably no manager has done more with less. Is that overstating it, or is that fair, do you think?
It's probably overstating it a little bit, but it's a very emotional overstatement, and which I think is completely acceptable. And I think if I were a Newcastle fan, I would feel really bereft.
Do you want to?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's negligent what Ashley is doing, but that's the way he operates. But I wasn't surprised Rafa Benitez decided against renewing his contract.
No, me neither, not at all.
But because he's wasting his time there, he is. I'm not saying Newcastle isn't a big enough club for him, because the potential they have is huge, but Newcastle in its current state is beneath Rafa Benitez.
Do you want to have a little run through the next manager who'll be wasting his time? Jose and Arteta are the favourites. Roy Keane, 14-1. Philip Cocu, 25s. Thierry Henry at 33. You can get 50 for Pardew or Allardyce. 80, Dennis...
Well, Pardew still has a year to run on that contract he signed in, 2000 and... 11.
Dennis Wise or Thomas Tuchel, 80-1. Not as a management duo. That'd be fun. 100-1, Shola Ramayobi. 500-1, Ant from Ant and Dec. 500-1, Ant and Dec. but Mourinho is... is it Mark Hudson? Alan Hudson's son, who managed Bahrain, managed New Zealand. I think he is being... he's possible as well. But Mourinho at St. James... I mean, it would be great, wouldn't it, Philippe?
Yeah, it would be absolutely hilarious, actually. It's not going to happen, is it?
No. What about Arteta?
I think you would have to be... There would need to be something wrong with you to take that job. Your career would need to be damaged to the point where you're so desperate to manage in the Premier League, that is the only job you will take.
Or exactly the opposite, where you think, actually, I can try and like make a point about how brilliant I could be as a manager with such a in such ridiculous circumstances.
But he's groomed to take over from Pep Guardiola. And Pep Guardiola might only stay one more season. I mean, that's the word on the grapevine, is that he's not going to stay for the full two seasons. So there might be one of the biggest jobs in English football waiting for him.
Arteta has such immaculate hair. I wonder how quickly it would be dishevelled and grey if he went to St James's Park. If we could run two simultaneous experiments. So I suspect his hair will be that perfect when he's 80, unless he takes the Newcastle job. Sam asks, was your hummus and grilled vegetable panini toasted? This is because...
Surely aren't paninis only ever toasted?
Well, I don't know, but it was. When I did a little WhatsApp for the pod, you know, to announce the Rafa news wasn't going to be in the pod while sitting down to have a panini. And yes, Sam, it was toasted. Thank you.
What kind of panini was it?
It was hummus and roasted vegetables.
Yeah.
Thank you, Barry. Frank Lampard, Derby's Frank Lampard is in... Frank Lampard's Derby's Frank Lampard is in... talks to be Chelsea's new manager. James says, will Frank Lampard be sacked in October or November? What do you think, Philippe?
Neither.
It feels like a sort of... It seems like the timing is... this whole transfer ban really suits him. I think Derby fans have been really angry about the way this has been covered. I think I got told off a lot by saying, look, you just need to know your place in the food chain, right? Frank Lampard is obviously going to leave Derby for Chelsea, but do their fans have a point that they should be, you know, they gave Frank Lampard an opportunity, Mel Morris gave him an opportunity?
Well, I think he did his part of the job. He did his job extremely well. It took them actually quite close to promotion, so what's the problem with that? But Frank Lampard, I mean, if you think that Solskjaer is still in place at Manchester United because of his credit as a former player, what the credit of Frank Lampard must be at Chelsea. I think you can be talking perhaps October, November 2021 or 2022.
Derby would never poach anyone, I presume, to manage their club.
Of course not.
Nobody works when someone's doing it to you.
Yeah. Although, actually, I think a few of their... I looked at that and I think their recent appointments... I can't remember the last one they actually poached, because I think Rowett was out of work. Shall I have a little look?
Yeah, Jonathan Wilson made it kind of an interesting point in a recent podcast that he's looking forward to Frank Lampard getting the Chelsea job because if he fails, he's curious to see how his many cheerleaders in the press box will try and make excuses for any failure he might encounter. Then again, he might do very well. Personally, I think he'll be... probably okay. I don't think he'd pull up any trees. I thought he did a reasonably good job at Derby, but ultimately failed to get them promoted.
But he has to take it. I mean, you can't not take it, right?
Of course he should. But, I mean, he doesn't have to take it now. It will come up again. It's the Chelsea job.
It's true.
Yeah, but it's coming at a moment which might be ideal for an up-and-coming manager because there's a new order or disorder being put in place at Chelsea with noises about Marina Granovskaya actually taking a role not being quite the same, with Petr Cech arriving as well, with Eden Hazard going, with the situation with the 40-odd players who are on loan at the moment, with a few new young players. You know, Loftus-Cheek and Hudson-Odoi are going to come back into the team at some point. And it might be a model they've decided, maybe that Chelsea has finally decided to change the model, which is something they've been talking about for a very long time, which it changed once, which is with the Arnesen situation, and which needs changing again. So, you know, probably the timing is good.
And I think if you ask any Chelsea fan, they absolutely love him, and managers tend not to get much love at Chelsea. So it's probably a risk for him more than anything. But I think given what Philippe's just said, the time might be quite ripe. And, you know, with all the players on loan, etc., they, you know, you could argue that, him and Jody Morris are going to be good for the younger players. And they'll give him more time. They will give him more time.
Jody Morris has actually been excellent with the younger players. It surprised a few people along the way.
Why are you so convinced they'll give him more time?
Because I think they love him so much. And I actually did a little poll of a number of Chelsea fans yesterday on this very subject. And every single one of them said the same thing about how much they love him and that they will have a different approach to him as a manager than they have with any of their recent managers.
I'm looking up football derby managers from the 20s. George
20s.
George Jobby, he was poached from running a hotel in 1925. He was at Wolves in 24.
Did the hotel pay any compensation?
Well, we don't know that. he was at Wolves, then he went to run a hotel. It appears that they didn't poach Harry Newbold, Jimmy Medvin, or Cecil Potter. So it's possible that Derby are just the most...
They're the only football club in the league that are beyond reproach. I may owe them a huge apology.
Ted Magner managed Denmark before moving to Huddersfield, where he managed during the Second World War, and Derby County, when he won a double of Football League North and the Midlands Cup in 94-95. But it doesn't say whether Derby poached Magna from Huddersfield or not. Stuart McMillan, I mean, I don't know how long I could do this for. No, Derby was his first job. This is extraordinary, isn't it? Jack Barker, November 1953. Let's see if Jack Barker comes up trumps. No. He was manager of Dundalk in 1947-48. Then he took over Derby in 1953. I don't know what he did during the Cold War, the beginning of the
Maybe he
Cold
was on
War.
Gardening leave from Dundalk.
He resigned to go back to work in Derby as a fitter's mate at the Carriage and Wagon Railway Works in Derby. I'm going to carry on this mission.
No.
Harry Storer Jr.,
Sounds like he should be a crooner.
Yeah.
Well, hang on. He became manager of Coventry, guiding them to the Third Division South in 35-36. He left in 1945 to manage Birmingham, leading them to the Second Division title. He resigned as Birmingham manager in 1948 for a second spell at Coventry, which lasted until December 1953. Took over as manager of Derby in June 55. So literally, Derby County, extraordinary. They never, ever poached a football manager. Obviously, there's probably one they poached about 10
years
ago.
I bet in the 90s. It happened in the 90s.
Oh, well, you asked the 90s?
Yeah, go on. Let's see the 90s.
The list of 90s Derby County managers.
Did they really clough off anyone, did they?
So they had...
Ah, there you go.
Bingo.
There you go.
Was it Sunderland they nicked clough from?
Did they? I mean, Brian Clough's Wikipedia will be too long.
Have a look.
The nice one for these ones, you know, Cecil Potter's Wikipedia is manageable in a podcast environment. In the 90s, they went through Arthur Cox, Roy McFarlane, Billy McEwen, and that was it. And then
I need to know who...
They nicked Brian Clough off Hartlepool.
Now, there we go.
There we go. Absolute outrage, Derby County fans. You do not have
utter hypocrites.
Do not have a leg to stand on. Well, I enjoyed that.
That didn't
journey.
Take long, did it?
No, it didn't at all. There's no time for part three. We'll see you on Monday. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Copa America time. In Group C, Uruguay beat Chile. They secured top spot thanks to a late header from Edison Cavani.
Fabulous header.
Talk me through it.
Oh, a cross coming from the left-hand side and in which he cut the trajectory of the ball and placed a header from about 15 yards out, bang in the corner of the net. Absolutely magnificent.
Completely underrated skill, heading the ball. I've said it before, I'll say it again. People just presume you should score headers. It's not that easy.
I can't head a ball for toffee and never could.
There you go, exactly. And, you know, you're an elite footballer.
Mm.
Two fun things from Luis Suarez in this game. He's utter desperation to get anybody booked for anything. First of all, he appealed for handball against the Chile goalkeeper, which, I mean, he caught himself.
That's one of the best things I've ever seen.
So good. It's a shame that he realises what he's appealing for. You know, it's that switch to appeal for something is so close to being on permanently for Luis Suarez, isn't it? That he just starts going, look, he handballed it. And then he appealed for Chile's, is it Jara? To be
Jara
to be shown a card after he tackled the pitch invader, and everyone laughed at this. Although, thanks to Lars Sivertsen, tweeted bizarrely, Suarez was actually right. Violent conduct is when a player uses or attempts to use excessive force or brutality against an opponent when not challenging for the ball, or against a teammate, team official, match official, spectator, or any other person, regardless of whether contact is made. So there you go. So
he should have been sent off then.
He should have been. Luis Suarez, wow. Absolutely right. Japan and Ecuador are both
we
out.
We should put Luis Suarez in charge of IFAB. That would be fun.
I mean, that is one handball you should have been sent off for, isn't it, if we're really honest? Luis Suarez, absolutely nailed. That is, he's got it right. He knows when a handball is a red card. Japan and Ecuador are both out. They ended their campaigns with a 1-1 draw. So the quarterfinal lineup: Brazil, Paraguay, Venezuela, Argentina, Colombia, Chile, and Uruguay, Peru. AFCON, Group D, Ivory Coast won 1-0 against South Africa. Aston Villa's Jonathan Kodjia scored in the second half. In Group E, Tunisia and Angola cancelled each other out in a 1-1 draw. Mali go top. They thrashed Mauritania 4-1.
Fabulous goals, by the way. Look at them. The Malian goals are absolutely spectacular. Three of them, magnificent strikes.
Brilliant from this game is Adama Traore scored, was then taken off and replaced by Adama Traore, who also scored. And neither of those Adama Traores are the Adama Traore who plays for Wolves. It's wow. Just tremendous, isn't it? In Group F, Cameroon began their trophy defence with a 2-0 victory over Guinea-Bissau. Two goals in 3 minutes, one from Yaya Banana, which is one of the greatest names in football.
And Cameroon, who nearly, again, didn't take part in the competition. They arrived at the very, very last second almost to play that game. And yet again, its problems with the bonuses, which were supposed to be paid, hadn't been paid or been paid and not been paid and so forth. But they're there. A miracle.
Group F, Benin held 10-man Ghana to a 2-2 draw.
Great game.
Mikel Pote scored twice for Benin.
Jordan, do you think Cameroon's players should be offered bonuses for not complaining about the non-payment of bonuses, which might sort of lead to more harmonious tournament experiences for them?
I didn't understand the question.
But surely if they're not being paid the bonuses, giving them a bonus for not being paid the bonus doesn't make any sense.
Just every tournament they enter, they are qualify for, they seem to sort of scupper their own chances by squabbling over unpaid bonuses. So it's just sort of go, we'll give you a bonus if you just don't complain about the bonuses you're not getting.
Oh, I really want a non-complaining bonus in my contract. Both the Ayew brothers scored for Ghana. That's nice, isn't it? Jordan and Andre, they'll always have that. Would anybody like to know the nickname for Benin's national football team?
Yes, and the Squirrels.
The Squirrels. Mm-hmm. Do you know why?
In fairness, no, I don't. But you're good to tell me.
Well, Cecil Potter moved from Derby to... I don't know the answer. Sadio Mane on AFCON. I would be prepared to swap my Champions League medal to win AFCON. Senegal's never won it. The return to Dakar would be extraordinary. This is my biggest and most crazy dream.
And I think it genuinely means it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Philippe, batten down the hatches, everybody. You've written a piece in Jos & Mar with the headline, Gianni Infantino campaigned heavily in Africa to get the unknown Ahmed Barry leans back. Elected as CAF president, now the FIFA president is desperately trying to put out the fire he started without burning himself. You have 1 minute. Your time starts. Your specialist subject is Gianni Infantino and CAF, and your time starts now.
To avoid Barry falling off his chair and Mr. Producer from spending the rest of the afternoon frantically editing, I will say, why don't you read the piece on the Jos & Mar website? It's only the first installment of
how many words
several.
Is it?
This one is 4,500 words. Yeah, I mean, that's only a start.
It's actually a good read.
I might go back to inverting the pyramid. That's, you know, okay. Can you do, as Barry said before the pod, can you do some bullet points for people like us?
Bullet points. No, honestly, it would take far too much time. And I wanted to say something else about the AFCON.
Oh, yeah, do.
Which is an absolute scandal, is the fact that there is nobody in the stadiums. Because quite a lot has been made out of the fact that the stadiums in France are not absolutely full. But actually, there's quite, you know, the attendances are pretty good and are getting better. And also what people forget is that in previous tournaments, very often you had packages and several games. Yeah. This time it's different for the first time. And anyway, the attendances are not catastrophic. In Egypt, it is catastrophic. It's appalling. You see the pictures of a game between Mali and Mauritania and so forth, and you realize the stadium is 5% full, if that. And it's a very depressing sight, especially since it's probably, in terms of the football that is being played, for me, one of the most enjoyable AFCONs that I've seen in a while, but an absolute disaster in terms of the organization. Obviously, moving the competition from Cameroon to Egypt didn't necessarily help, and also putting the tickets at far too high prices hasn't helped either. But it's disastrous, and honestly, when you see all the rubbish that's happening in African football at the moment, and heavens above, read the Yosimar piece to have an idea. It's the last thing that this tournament needs at the moment.
They're having similar problems at the Copa America, aren't they?
Yeah, they have.
Low
yeah.
attendances, overpriced tickets, etc., and so on.
Would anybody like to know the quarterfinal lineup for the Gold Cup?
Go on.
Sure.
Haiti v Canada, Mexico v Costa Rica, Jamaica will play USA or Panama, probably Panama, and Curaçao will play USA or Panama, probably the USA.
Come on, Costa Rica, I say.
I say, come on, Haiti.
Fair.
Come on, Haiti.
Curaçao. Well, that's who I'm supporting. And Martinique.
Wasn't he a Japanese filmmaker? Sorry.
That's okay.
It's a blue liqueur, isn't it?
I know a story about someone who was going away on holiday and drank a lot of Curaçao the night before they left and then was sick in the night and then woke up. And they'd been sick in their suitcase, and they were late for their planes. They had to just close the suitcase.
Oh my goodness!
So by the time their suitcase arrived in wherever it was all blue and vomity. So it's a nice story for everyone.
Key ingredient in one of the 70s most fancied cocktails, the Blue Lagoon.
Ah, really?
Yeah.
Costa Rica, no army. All money goes into education.
And they've got a lot of canopy walks, tree canopy walks.
Beautiful.
In Haiti. Could do with a bit of something to feel good about.
That's true.
That is also true.
Can we have a Haiti Costa Rica final?
Yeah.
Do you think?
No.
Have that. We'll vote for that.
No.
You can't, because that would be a semi final. On Monday we didn't know where Martinique was, and for some reason we didn't just check. We didn't know anything about it. More fool me, because it's the country next to Guadeloupe, and they mention it a lot on Death in Paradise, which I absolutely love. So I should have known that. So many apologies for our lack of knowledge on that. News from Argentina. San Jorge de Tucumán players, if that's how I pronounce it, held a sit-down protest during a match against Alvarado de Mar del Plata in the second match of a promotion playoff to the second division. Players protested against what they considered to be a bad performance by the referee, who sent off two of their players in the first half. The ref suspended the game and gave the win to the opposition, who were subsequently promoted. Makes the Cameroon women's side look, frankly, sort of well-behaved, doesn't it, really? Danny Taylor's exclusive about the FA Cup, the Nottingham Forest replica. Have you heard this?
No.
The Guardian's learned about an extraordinary legal wrangle involving Nottingham Forest and their former owner, Fawaz Al-Hassawi, and the replica of the 1959 FA Cup that's gone missing from the City Grounds trophy cabinet. He says, in another sign of the deteriorating relations between the club's current and former regimes, the two times European Cup winners have brought in lawyers to write to Hassawi saying their information is that he removed the FA Cup at some unspecified point, stating they want it back. Hassawi's counter-argument is the trophy was commissioned when he was the club's owner at a cost of £23,000, and he believes that entitles him to think of it as his own possession. The idea of just having an FA Cup that isn't really yours on your mantelpiece is just so ludicrous.
Should we ask for maybe the descendant of that dog who found the Jules Rimet Cup?
Pickles.
Pickles.
Pickles, yes. Mm. It's a job for Pickles.
It's a job for the litter of Pickles.
Well, I was at a AFC Wimbledon's ground earlier, or last season, before an FA Cup game for Media Day with Wally Downs and various players. And I was looking at some of the memorabilia. It's like an old school clubhouse, basically. And I was looking at some of the memorabilia there while waiting. And Vinnie Jones's FA Cup final, the box which contained his medal is there with a message from Vinnie, you know, enjoy, whatever. And but the medal wasn't there. Ooh. So I was wondering, did he only donate the box? Or did someone nick the medal? Or did they only put the medal out on special occasions, you know, to make when it can be watched and minded?
I could WhatsApp Vinnie and find out if you want.
If you want to.
Okay. Here's a question from Mike Duncan, who presents a history podcast, and he's currently writing a biography of the Marquis de Lafayette. That's not important right now. He says, can you please
it's have... Marquis.
Marquis.
He's not a tent.
You don't know that. Can you please have Philippe Auclair say, I love watching Ligue 1 Uber Eats?
I really have to do that.
Well, you don't have to. Mike wanted you to, but you don't have to.
Okay.
The match ball, you know,
I love to watch Ligue 1 Uber Eats.
Yeah. Well, you know that Uber Eats are going to sponsor Ligue 1 from 2021. The match ball will be brought onto the pitch by an Uber Eats driver ahead of each Ligue 1 game. Ligue 1 game, excuse me. We don't know if it will be a car or a bicycle Uber Eats delivery. Ligue Dirt is currently partnered with Domino's Pizza, so you know, at least there's some consistency there, which is, after all we want in the game, isn't it?
French gastronomy, of course. Uber Eats and Domino's Pizza.
Can you order like posh French, really posh, high-end, Michelin-starred food on Uber Eats? I'll have the confit of duck on a bed of...
Some excessively rich and creamy...
I'd like a foie gras jus, please, delivered with my meat feast. Transfer news. Andre Gomez signing from Barcelona for Everton, £22 million. Mm-hmm. Good, good. We all think that's a good
thing. Good bit of
business, that. Yeah, David Silva's going to stay at City for another year. Nice for them. Guardian today reporting, amongst other people, that Spurs are making a between 55 and 65 million bid for Tungay and Ndombele. It's
been Tungay and Ndombele.
Dongi.
Okay. Dongi.
Dongi.
Ndombele.
I mean, my French pronunciation is not the best. Gangon, etc.
That was good.
Thank you so much. I watched a YouTube reel of Ndombele.
Looks good, doesn't he?
Obviously think he's better than Messi, as YouTube reels know. how good is he?
He's excellent. I find the price a little bit high, but I'm looking forward to having Jean-Michel Aulas and Daniel Levy haggling over the cost of Tanguy Ndombele. That should be quite fun.
I imagine you have to start high with Levy anyway.
Yeah,
probably. I on the subject of YouTube,
he said something like, "Oh, we want to keep Ndombele. The door is not, say, entr'ouverte. So it's like it's just a jar, just a little bit, but it would take an awful lot of money to open it fully."
Let's see what
it's
happens.
Definitely what Spurs need, though. I think. You know,
centre midfielder who can drive with the ball, and it seems like
technically very good.
He can play an excellent pass on the run as well, which is a difficult skill. On the subject of YouTube highlights reels, I've been watching a lot of Wes Houlihan since he's currently putting Cambridge United on trial. I'm worried to talk about it because I don't want other clubs to realise he's there. But the great thing about the Wes Houlihan YouTube reel is it's him setting up Cameron Jerome to miss a lot of chances. He thoroughly enjoyed it. Mike, for Philippe, would PSG be better off without the constant distraction and drama of Neymar?
I'm really in two minds about this one, because regardless of all the nonsense surrounding Neymar and the fact that he seems to be incapable of playing throughout the whole season, he very often was, again, the best player at Paris Saint-Germain last season, despite all the problems he's had and he's having, on one hand. On the other, the distraction is proving a little bit too much. I can actually give you, not the kind of breaking news, but some inside information.
Oh, yes.
Yes, would you like that?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Is that it is actually correct that Neymar has had words about with Nasser Al-Khelaifi, the chairman of PSG, and indicated his desire to leave the club.
All right. Finally, Gordon said, can we have an update on Barry's one-man super soaker reign of terror on his street, please? And another Gordon, or the same Gordon, alerted me to something you can get on Amazon, which is a wood quail baton shield bamboo self-defense nightstand safe bedside table gift idea, which is a baton shield can be set as a helpful self-defense accessories in order to visually warn the intruder you are protected. It's a shield and a bat, But what you can do is you can the bat acts as a table leg, and you can use it as a bedside table. And then when the intruder comes, you can just get the shield and then have the bat ready.
But what if you like have a radio on it and a glass of
water? Yeah,
28 books,
a packet of fags and ash.
17 mugs of water, exactly. Yeah, the bamboo material gives the bat and shield their effortless chic. As with all of our bamboo products, this one has been varnished to protect it against wear and tear and to make cleaning easy. It can also be a piece of modern designer furniture if you use it as a bedside table. The staples can be used for cables. There's one review. Should we see what the review says?
This is slightly like Cosmo Kramer from Seinfeld's coffee table book about coffee tables that also doubles as a coffee table.
One review on the 4th of October 2015 from MJ Tucker. Could be better.
I've got a coffee table that's shaped as a coffee cup.
I haven't even started the review yet.
Oh.
The torso size shield is ideal. Allow for the protection of vitals and or blimey, and or genitals in the excuse me, in the event of an assault. Picture clearly shows a left-handed user, but is equally usable for righties. The leg bat appears to be shorter than a baseball bat, but longer than a rounder's one. Depending on a user's size and ability, this combination can make a formidable defensive or offensive tool. The cons, however, must of course be obvious. Although bamboo is tough and light, the slated construction would have me wishing for it to be leather covered for additional strength without compromising the weight, or for the stronger user as a one piece thick board construction. The bat is overlong for indoor use. Ceiling height and hall dimensions would prevent fullest g-force. Might give an opportunist burglar second thoughts, but not a determined assailant. To that end, I would suggest replacing the bat with something sharp and serious looking, a serrated edged hunting knife clippable to the shield for storage. Close quarters survival fighting, you need every advantage. If knives scare you, then I suggest some nice long nails, 6 inch plus near the top. They'd be hidden when used as a table, but when brandished at an opponent, running away would seem like a sweeter deal.
Bloody hell.
13 people found this helpful.
You
say 13.
The future former Mrs. Rustin now. Should get one of those for when you're about to body slam her in the middle of the night.
Anyway, that'll do. Philippe, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you, Baz.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Monday. Actually, before we see you on Monday, before we left the room, which is convenient, this tweet from David Ornstein: Man United have reached an agreement with Crystal Palace to sign Aaron Wan-Bissaka in a deal worth $50 million. He's going to have a medical, long-term contract, 80,000 to 90,000 a week. Man U retained 25% sell-on clause for Wilfried Zaha. Okay, that's interesting, isn't it? We're not surprised about this, Philippe, are we? We thought it would happen.
No, I thought it would happen. Is the Wilfried Zaha bit, which actually made me pregnant by us. Yes, the fact that Wan-Bissaka wanted to go to Man United is not exactly news.
No, but yeah. Is it good for him?
It's good for it's very good for Manchester United. It's really a position in which they needed to find somebody. And also, it's interesting. It seems to confirm the fact that they've decided to go for younger players and to engage into perhaps a different project than what they had, or non-project as they had over the past few seasons. Yes,
Barry, any thoughts on Aaron Wan-Bissaka?
He's a very good player. He didn't have a good under-21 championships, and the general consensus seems to have been that he was distracted by talk of this big money move to Manchester United. Chris was just saying that you're not sure why he'd go to United, and I can see why. You know, I would imagine he had no shortage of suitors, and that seems a slightly odd move, but, you know, good for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, well, good that happened before we left the room. Now, Chris and Barry, you can talk more about Chris's coffee table, coffee cup-shaped coffee table, which got you very interested.
Yes. Yeah. We're trying to find it on the internet.
Excellent. And you guys can do that at home as well. We'll be back on Monday.
I love to watch Liga Uber Eats.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.